So I think you just have to own your stereotype a little bit. Use it to your advantage, basically, because we want to be employed.
Yep.
And so if your stereotype is jerk lawyer, and all of a sudden there's a big role where you're on TV for 4 years and a recurring role as jerk lawyer, how fantastic. So, you know, instead of being upset about that, I'd be thrilled that you're employed for 4 years, and then you can, in your own time, go, well, what else am I interested in? Mm. And how do I get people to see that, you know?
You're listening to An Actor and a Mic, an interview-style podcast focused on the tumultuous yet spectacular journeys of Australian artists. Welcome to the 29th episode. This episode, I spoke with what I would say is a fairly big inspiration on my work ethic and ideas when it comes to the theatre scene here in Australia, Amy Ingram. Amy is a director, actor, producer, and kind of all-round theatre maker. If any of those professions interest you, then stick around, because I found Amy's perspective on the industry one of hustling and maintaining a level of realism while also maintaining a clear passion for it. I get into more of Amy's history at the start of the interview, so I'll leave this one short. I do have to add, though, that when I did the interview with Amy, our connection was very stop and go. And there are actually parts where her answers are just unintelligible. So I'm attempting to hotfix it by using my own voice and putting in what I believe she was saying at the time. So hopefully within that, I don't misconstrued anything she was saying. And every bit of overlaid audio is not directly Amy's thoughts. They are just what I believe her to have said. Hopefully it's not too jarring. It's similar to what I did with Laura Trenary's interview. But the parts that you can hear are very good. So perfect. Now all the disclaimers are out of the way. Here comes the interview. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 29 of An Actor and a Mic. This time around, I'm speaking with Amy Ingram. So Amy is both an actor and a voiceover artist, while also being a director and a producer. In 2008, Amy co-founded the Good Room Theatre Company, a company I have actually spoken about before on this podcast. She has done quite a lot of work with both La Boite and Queensland Theatre. She's also a co-founder of Myths Made Here, which the tagline for is, "We believe in a good story well told," which is, I quite enjoy that. Ignoring all the theatre stuff she's done in Australia, Amy also splits her time between here and America, looking for more film-related roles over there. And this brings me to the point of what I'm really looking forward to in this interview, is sort of Amy's outlook of the American-Australian sort of acting culture and the lessons she may have learnt from taking on America while also maintaining a very frequent basis of sort of projects here in Australia. So all of that is why I am very eager to speak to Amy Ingram. So hello, Amy. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks.
Are you?
How's it all going on your end?
Oh, yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. I messed up the time because Amy's actually in Sydney right now. So I didn't realize that she was an hour in front of us. So I frantically found that out about 30 minutes before this and sent her the Zoom link and was like, oh God, please. I hope, are we still all good? I'll get there, I promise. So that was a bit of a,
but frantic. Yet here we are.
Yeah. Thank God. and I believe you just came back from the gym too. So how was
I
that?
I did. Yes. That was torture. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, cool. And being down in Sydney, you are currently doing for Magic Mike, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm doing the tour of Magic Mike Live Australia.
Yeah.
Female MC.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So
crazy. We just did our 70th show. So we kicked off in November of last year, but COVID put a little stopper on that. And then we started up again. And so we've been pretty steady since then. So it's a 10 show a week spiel. So I'm not gonna lie, I'm quite tired. but it's been going really well. The show has been really well received and it's a lot of fun. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. And what is your, so that you're the female MC. What does the female MC do in the show?
What doesn't she do? I guess without giving too much away, I guess you go through the show through me, if that makes sense. I describe it as like she's the architect of your experience.
Wow.
So she is the host and then takes you through, I guess, the journey of all the boys and the dancing and the shirts coming off.
Yeah. Has that been fairly enjoyable for you from both an artistic and an aesthetic perspective? Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh, look, the struggle is real.
Yeah. Oh, it's such. Has this been, like, would you call it a fairly easy role?
Yes and no. It's different in that it's not like I'm playing a
character. It's easier in the sense that I am playing an extension of myself.
I mean, I'm basically wielding anywhere from, like, you know, 200 to 450 people a night. So you really have to stay very switched on because each audience brings its own energy and you have to kind of ride that energy to make sure that everyone's having a good time, but that the show stays on track as well. So it's it keeps me on my toes. Yeah.
You make it seem like it's almost each night is fairly different.
It is in that some nights are wilder, like the something in the waters, and there are other nights where they're quite conservative, and so you have to kind of make sure that they're enjoying themselves and we're all kind of giving each other the energy needed to make the show like work. So it's just sort of gauging each night as it comes, really.
Yeah.
So and because it's very interactive in terms of we're very aware of each other, we talk to each other, we're present there. It's not a sit down, watch a show, clap, leave, and it's done. Yeah, both awesome. Parties are acknowledging each other the entire time, which means that there's room for change depending on what you're given. So
yeah. Yeah, that sounds great. It sounds like you're sort of having a good time down in there in Sydney, despite the COVID worries, of course.
Oh yeah. You know,
that's
you just can't get away from it. So
yeah, that's just us now. Yay. So with these interviews, I sort of like to go all the way back because I kind of like to build a picture of sort of where you've come from, who you are, and kind of where you want to go potentially. I just wanted to ask, when you were growing up, were you always interested in the arts in some capacity?
I was. I knew from a pretty young age that I wanted to be an actor. And I mean, I changed my mind a lot as a kid. I was like, now I'm going to be an AMBO, and now I'm going to be a doctor, and now I'm going to be a lawyer. But I realized that all I wanted was to, like, do those things, like, as a role. I didn't actually really want to see it through. I didn't actually want to be a doctor full time. Yes. I just wanted to play one because it seemed fun for a hot second.
Yeah.
So, and I've been told many stories from family members about me deciding to, like, hold court at the dinner table and tell stories. And even in primary school, I knew I wanted to do performance stuff. Mm. So I guess I'm lucky in a way that I always knew that this is what I wanted. But the idea of that, I think, has shifted as I've gotten older in terms of, like, what it means to be an artist as opposed to, like, just a famous person who does things. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
The 13-year-old version of what this life is versus the 30-plus-year-old version, two very different things.
Yeah. One has a lot more knowledge than the other as well. Yeah, that's great. And then from sort of once your schooling ended, you undertook your first years of study at Flinders University in South Australia.
Yeah.
And then you went on to move and complete your degree in Toowoomba. So what was that like time in your life like?
Well, okay, I'm going to be honest. I auditioned to get into the Flinders Acting School and wasn't successful the first year. And so I did a more of a general arts degree where it had elements of acting courses and things like that, with the understanding that then they kind of encourage you to do that to then re-audition the year after. But I hated it so much. I hated not doing what I wanted. And I think I was probably just like, just quite like sore at them for not accepting me. Just a small country town girl. And I was like, why aren't I in? And I think I just needed
a change. One of my earliest memories from USQ was
kind of us driving up the range, wondering what the hell I'm doing. So, yeah.
And then you did 3 years at Toowoomba, did you not?
Yes.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was interesting because I grew up in the country. Toowoomba was just like a bigger version with more cows than what I was used to. But because Toowoomba was like isolated from everywhere else, it was very intense. So it was like a very intense 3 years of like the course, only the course, 100% the course. Yeah. So it was good in a way because I just kind of threw myself into it and really just concentrated on that for those 3 years and then had to kind of reemerge into the big wide world again after graduation.
Of course. Yeah. That's, did they prepare you for stepping out into the industry, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I mean, that definitely, the focus of that was definitely more in third year, and that's when you started to meet people and go and do things more and stuff like that. But to be honest, I did feel still quite on the outer for a little bit when I first graduated. I didn't feel like I had been ingratiated into the industry as much, say, like QUT had been, just because they were there in Brisbane all the time. So that was a little tricky at first, and I think that's a thing that USQ has always done. But we have such a good work ethic ingrained into us that I think we found our people. I found people very quickly after graduating that I was like, oh, yeah, we'll work together well. And just kind of put my head down and concentrated on that. So, yeah, because a lot of people still wanted to do the Great Southern Drift, as it was called, which is down to Melbourne or down to Melbourne or Sydney. But I'd already done the move to Queensland. I just didn't have it in me to move again. And I just kind of was like, I think I need to just try and crack Brisbane and then think about whatever else I should be doing. So, yeah, so I stayed in Brisbane and it was good. It worked out, I think.
Yeah, I think it did definitely good things for you. So you graduated at USQ in 2004 and then the Good Room was conceived in 2008. What about those 4 years in between graduation and Good Room? Well, what did you get up to?
I did a lot of weird independent stuff. So I did, at the Judith Wright Centre, there was a thing called the Emerge Project, which I was really heavily involved in. It was about like giving directors and new actors like platforms. It was like lots of 10-minute plays and weird new writings and really low budget, no budget stuff, just like putting on stuff a lot. And then that's where I met Dan Evans, who's one of my major creating partner, I guess. And we decided to apply to do the National Young Writers Festival as co-directors. And so we applied and I don't know why, but they said yes, they hired us as an emerging kind of co-artistic directors of a festival, a writing festival. And so we did that for 2 years and that's where we decided to form the Good Room, actually, because we started to meet all these people from around Australia and we're doing all this stuff and realised that we just needed more of an outlet for our creative brains and then, yeah, formed the Good Room. But the Good Room was very different than to what it is now.
Oh.
Yeah. So the Good Room started off as many young independent theatre companies do, which is as a showcasing platform. We knew that we had to get work up and out there for people to know who we were and to get more work. So we wanted to do it in our own way, I guess. So we produced one of Dan Evans's plays and partnered with Backbone Youth Arts when it was back in Metro Arts. So basically we hit up Metro Arts, we hit up Backbone, and we said, we're forming this new company. Will you help us? We want to produce Holy Guacamole, which Backbone had produced the year before, actually, as a part of there was a really short season and it was using young people. And we're like, we want to do the production and cast it with all age appropriate stuff, so cast an older person as the grandma and things like that, as opposed to a bunch of like 20-year-olds playing all the characters. And they were like, yep, great idea. So that was our first production and went really well. We took it to Adelaide Fringe to test it out.
Wow.
And then we took it and then we did the season in Adelaide, and then the year after that Tammy Weller, as a friend of ours who's a really great writer as well, she'd written a new play, and so we teamed up with her to do her show Single Admissions, and we did the same thing. We took it to Adelaide, did a little test run on it, and then took it to Brisbane and did it. And so then we kind of kept evolving that way. But Dan and I were always
aware of audience engagement.
Because we were definitely doing still traditional plays, but we were trying to make it in a way that the audience had much more involvement and that it wasn't such a sit down, watch, go home, forget about the show, you know, the next day situation. So we started to look way more into contemporary theatre making models and branching out and talking to different people. And that's when we sort of brought on Lauren Cleland and Kieran Swan. And we came up with the model of asking for anonymous submissions to create work. And then that's now the Good Room as is. So we did about three years or so of us just kind of working on our own, I guess, individual practice in the Good Room. And then we used that time to form the new version of the Good Room.
That's really interesting. It sounds like, well, as you said, most independent theatre sort of started as a showcase thing and then you kind of evolved into what you really wanted.
Yeah.
That the Good Room has become, like, personally for me, from my perspective, it feels like a very young and intuitive sort of theatre company. It feels like the ideas and shows that you put on feel like they definitely go against a lot of traditional theatre values in that way. And that,
yes,
that feels very interesting to people of my age. And so it's definitely hit something, which is really cool.
Yeah, we I think in us sometimes being what we knew, we wanted to try something different. And it wasn't that we were always bored, it was just that we saw that there was a gap as well. For like we went and saw like when you go and see different, like, and especially working with the National Young Writers Festival, we saw people like Black Lung and Post do weird performance stuff, and we really kind of
took after them in that sense. And in this year, the company really shifted. It was that year
when we did single admissions and that sort of stuff, I think, really ignited in us going, we can tell stories and create art. It doesn't have to be in a linear narrative, traditional form. We can create experiences for people that they can take away with them as opposed to just another well-told story. And I mean, I love the well-told story, don't get me wrong. Like, I love it, but there's more out there in terms of like an experience in the theatre. So I think we just kind of lent into that more.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you certainly do. The productions can be very full on, but very, very, very engaging. And yeah, I'm just, yeah, it's definitely an asset to sort of the Queensland theatre scene. I wonder at this point in time, so after producing and being in so many Good Room shows, I wonder what that theatre company means to you now.
Well, it forms, I guess, part of the mass foundation that is my arts practice. So there is Amy Ingram as maker and performer of more contemporary theatre, whatever the word is. and then there's like Amy who does traditional theatre and plays and, you know, ads and voiceovers and just the normal kind of work
stuff, like gigging and making just the kind of projects that
stretch our arts practice beyond what we've done before. So it means I'm just never sitting on my butt waiting for things to happen, you know? And it means because I've done
so many different projects and productions, new experiences sit more comfortably with me.
I think it's just stretched my artistic practice in a way that's made it really valuable for me not being bored. So, yeah.
And it's given you that base as well, too, as you were saying, that if other projects don't work out or something, you can always come back to the Good Room and be like, hi, yeah, here's an idea of having, let's produce this.
Exactly. I'm not so attached to having to be hired.
Yeah. Which, that must be amazing feeling.
It's a real struggle for us as
performers. I mean, that whole thing of,
well, if I don't have a gig here, therefore I'm not a real actor, it's bullshit. So, you know, you need someone to hire you to tell you that you're a performer, but you need someone to hire you so you can earn money. it's a weird thing that having your own art practice, I think, is a really healthy way to be a gigging performer, an actor or artist without it resting on someone else's approval, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's, I guess, in most ways, that feels kind of like the dream, being able to produce and do your own sort of stuff, and it'd still be collaborative and bringing up young artists and entertaining guests, sending messages, yeah. And like that's I wonder if if you think for young artists now, how do you think starting up a theatre company would go these days? I'm just sort of more asking, it feels like there's a fairly large saturation in terms of fairly established companies. So I wonder if you think...
I think there's a gap in the market at the moment. There's not a lot of young emerging people come through. So the Good Room's been happening for over a decade now. So we were young and emerging, hitting that kind of mid-career range.
Yep.
We're still experimenting and practicing and doing emerging things, but you know, like we're getting older. So I definitely see that there's less young people starting up weird just to see how it goes. I think it's tricky because there's a lot of pressure for it to be successful from the get-go, and that may not necessarily be the case. You might start something and then you realize actually it's not quite right, and then we'll evolve and change to something different. And I think you have to be okay with that. Maybe you do start up the company with your three best mates and then 2 years later you realize actually it needs to change, and like that's okay, that's fine. Like things do pop up, and like you may start something that lasts a year or two, or you may start something that will last like 20 years and you won't know. We didn't know that the Good Room was going to last this long. We had no clue. So you got to kind of be okay to like roll with the punches a little bit, but not be afraid to put yourself out there, which is tricky. But I think in terms of anybody wanting to start their own stuff, the question you just have to ask yourself is like, who is it for? Who are you doing this for? And it can be for you and your career, but it also has to be for an audience. So if you desperately want to do like the Scarlet Letter word for word over a 7-hour iteration, fantastic. But who the fuck is watching that? You have twofold. And so, but you might make it in a way that actually everybody wants to see that. But make sure that you're asking, why are you doing it for you, but also why are you who's watching this? Whether that be even for like theater, film, whatever you're making, like who is this benefiting, I guess, or who is the audience?
Yeah.
And just make sure you're really into it and you really want to do it, because it's going to be love pushing it through for the first few years as opposed to financials. So just pick things that you are really passionate about, I guess. Yeah. And it's okay if it fails, because then you just do something else, you know?
So yeah. That idea of being able like open to change is definitely a big thing, because I feel reluctant to change certain things. Like if I were to start a theater company or a podcast or whatever, I would feel reluctant to change certain things in the worry that it wouldn't be received well. But
yeah,
that's,
and also you worry that you'll lose ground.
Yes,
that you've gained, but.
I used to worry about that stuff in terms of...
like leaving Brisbane, be like, well, it's Brisbane, and then once I come back, then there won't be a spot for me because I've left. And that's a real fear. Then people go, all right, I'm going to go to Sydney, and then they never leave Sydney because they're worried that then Sydney will forget them and then they'll never have a spot again. But I think the world is changing and we're much more digitally connected, et cetera. But also, it's a load of crap. You should definitely leave. You should leave. You should try things. You should go out. You should come back. You should... change your mind about stuff, start a podcast, and then 2 weeks later go, no, now I'm a visual artist. Like, whatever. So yeah. I think you just got to give it a go. But just make sure you really want to do it, really. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, let's slightly change tacks here. It's sort of talking about just giving it a go. I just wanted to talk about the American side of things now.
Yeah.
So in 2014, you received the Arts Queensland Independence Fund and to travel over to New York and further your studies at the Lee Strasberg Institute. So how was that?
That was pretty great.
Yeah.
So so what happened was I won the green card to go and to be able to live and work over there. And it was very random. I hadn't planned, like I entered on a whim after a few wines one night. Did not really think that was ever going to happen. And it did. And then I was like, oh, shit, okay. And so I went, all right, well, let's see if this, there's any point in this, which is why I then applied for the independence fund, because I was like, oh, maybe I can use this chance to go over and study more and experiment over there and see things and see if how I can also use it to benefit Goodroom and my arts practice back here. So I applied to go over and study and do an intensive with Strasbourg, but I also did an internship with Elevator Repair Service, which are a contemporary performance making company in New York. So they often take American classics or just classic tech and fuck with it. So I saw what they did in, before I went, of The Great Gatsby, but they did the entire book.
Wow.
So it was like a, oh God, it's fantastic. It was oddly set in an office and weird things would happen. And then you're like, oh my God. So that was another big kind of like moment of me wanting to see things to inspire me a little bit. And so I was straddling Strasbourg for just being a good old traditional actor and getting better at that. And then Elevator Repair Service as a more contemporary performance maker to kind of feed both channels there. Wow. So I went over and did that, and then I stayed on with Elevator Repair Service as an intern beyond that. So I stayed with them on and off for a couple of years doing stuff with them, just sort of fly on the wall.
With them on projects, which was good.
Except that I just wanted to try and get more opportunity and more skills. Yep. So it was definitely a hard push. New York is hard work. They're very welcoming, but then they're also like, you got to do the hard yards in New York, you know. They often say it takes a while to like crack in, and they're not lying. And sometimes people get lucky though, they just waltz on in and then all of a sudden, you know, you got some big role or whatever, but that was not my experience. But what it did do for me was change my perspective on the way I performed, and it changed my perspective on auditions and my care factor of auditions,
right?
And just a different kind of work ethic, I think. They audition all the time there because they can. And so that becomes that whole idea of like auditioning is your job, really. That instilled in me a lot more over there as opposed to in Australia when perhaps you're not auditioning as much as you would be over there, just because there's less saturation of work in Australia. And then that evolved, and I eventually was like, I'm just starting to get a bit more interested in film and TV and stuff. So I'm late to the game, I guess, with film and TV, because I always just concentrated so hard on theatre. But again, with me just being like, well, you know, just want to try some new stuff. So I've been, yeah. So I started doing way more workshops and stuff focused on meeting casting directors and film and TV people over in America. So, yeah, it was good. It was good. And then COVID.
Oh no. Yeah, that's so then with doing the elevator repair internship, you said you were there for doing it for a few years. Were you going over there and then flying back to do productions
For the last like, oh God, since 2014 I have been living out of a suitcase and living between America and Australia depending on work and opportunity and stuff. So it was anytime I would get work, and of course naturally as soon as I my big fear of leaving and losing my
place
was dumb, because as soon as I wanted to work
I had work,
so which was odd and ironic and probably the way it always happens for people, but I started to get Goodroom started to pick up, we started to get more opportunities, and I started to get offered more work back in Queensland. So I would come back to do those performances in Australia. And then during my downtime, I would go to America to keep continuing on with that kind of goal. So it was great for me in terms of my experience as a performer and a maker to keep doing the back and forth, but it was at detriment to my progress in America. Me leaving all the time meant that I did lose traction a bit in America, because they weren't, they would see me pop back up again and then be like, oh, that's right, we remember you, but where have you been? Or are you here for good? Or what's your intentions? So
I see.
That
was a very tricky thing to navigate.
Because I was like, well, of course, employ me. So you must, but you must stay before we employ you. So it was like a chicken and egg thing. So Yeah. So that was something tricky to kind of navigate between the two. But yeah. I always used America as a chance to like continue training, basically, and seeing things.
Right. So that was, so you would say that going over to America was sort of your time to like what, get better at auditions or just practice more different roles?
Do a career. Yeah. Yeah. It was still absolutely to pursue a career and get work. But then I also, on top of that, was like, use this time to continue training and seeing work, seeing plays, seeing stuff. So that one, so you know, again, not super depressed with just auditioning and
getting denied so often while also trying to gather enough money to feed yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Multitask.
Yeah.
So here we are at the mid-roll. It's weird to hear more of me than usual, huh? So in terms of my life, things were relaxing a bit since the last time you heard from me. But turns out that was just calm before the storm. Don't get me wrong, I'm loving my life, but it never stops. I'm currently homesick, and that is what is giving me time to actually do the podcast. I hope everyone is keeping themselves healthy and stress-free the best they can. Especially heading into winter, it's cold, rug yourselves up. So for a while, I've been having a bit of difficulty consistently producing this podcast. And that includes doing interviews as well as the editing and putting them out on time. Last year, I was very punctual. When I said every 2 weeks, every second Monday, that's when they would be out. Every second Monday, they were out. And now I changed it to every third Monday to try and compensate for what I knew was going to be a very busy year. And I did all right at that for a while, but lately I haven't been keeping up to it. And I actually don't think it's a massive issue because my feelings towards the podcast have shifted once again. So this podcast was originally an aspiration of mine to create some kind of following and information. And the way to do that would be through consistently posting and trying to get it out on word of mouth and all those kinds of things. As I've said on the podcast before, I've unsuccessfully tried Facebook advertisements and other things, but honestly, with the industry recently, there's been a lot of talk about archives. And it became apparent to me that it was more important that the information that this podcast provides gets out there and remain free than be something for me. Be some kind of launching platform for anything to do with my career. So obviously, if it was being produced by a larger team with more of a budget, then the quality would probably be better. It would also be posted more consistently. But where I'm sitting right now and how busy things have gotten, I think if I not rest on my laurels, but remain happy with the fact that I'm still getting that information out there, and that it is a place where people can easily get some fairly in-depth information about industry professionals in Australia, I think that's more important than anything the podcast ever could have given me. So this episode has come out a little bit late, and there are a bit of wavering production issues with it in terms of the internet connection I had with Amy. But I think I will use the every 3 weeks from now on as a kind of guideline instead of something I have to consistently pressure myself to get to, because like I said, I think it's more important to get it out there than not at all. And with how busy everything has been, I think it's probably the best move for me moving forward. I'm still going to be producing the podcast. I definitely think it's worthwhile, and I still love talking to the artists that I do. Just perhaps something with less of a rigorous timeline. So hopefully none of that seems irrational or annoying. When this episode comes out, there will be close to 29 hours worth of content on the Australian arts industry. And I think that's pretty astounding if you ask me. So with all that out of the way, I don't actually have any shout outs this week either. Later in the year, I may have some big news of my own, but for now, everything is seemingly a little quiet in my circles. So yeah, I hope you're keeping safe. I'll see you at the end, guys. Bye. We'll be right back.
What was the theatre like in America? Because I don't know, I've never had the chance to ask that.
Interesting. So there's obviously the big Broadway multi-million dollar shows. Millions and millions of dollars dropped into productions. And then you'd have two streets around the block of much Broadway stuff going on where a lot of things would first start out. And then downtown, which was where you had much more experimental theatre going on.
Right.
And then Brooklyn was in that as well. So then all the little theatres pocketed around. But what I found interesting were the fact that audiences would go from watching a big Broadway show to then going down and watching the two-hander low budget around, you know, downtown. Tourists, not so much.
But New Yorkers very much so.
So, and then some maybe led astray to different things, but local audiences, which are big, they're big. So like obviously Broadway is mostly tourists, but it has a strong local contingent of people that just love Broadway who live in New York. Mm. Yeah. But those audiences in particular will cross streams, which I found very interesting.
And sometimes the best thing you've
ever seen is the $1 show. And then vice versa, you look at some things and you go, that's what money can do. That's pretty incredible. That production is, you know, like it's amazing. So it was just great to see different, the entire broad scope of what theatre can be in a tiny island. So
absolutely. I really like the culture there of seeing a massive budget show and then being like, let's go watch something and
let's go watch these idiots cover each other with paint.
I really think because it doesn't feel like Australia has that at all. It feels like it's like either you watch your large budget things or you're the supporter of your friends.
Yeah, and also because we, you know, like Broadway has what, like 50 something theaters in like a 10 block radius. Like it's crazy the amount of that. Yeah. So Broadway is like 40th through to like 52nd Street. And then there's something like, I can't remember. I used to know this. I used to actually know this. It with one of my day jobs, I had to know these facts to sell tickets, but there's something like 50 theaters, Broadway theaters and a Broadway theater is classified as over 500 seats. So you've got smaller Broadway houses that are around 500, 600 seats, and then big Broadway houses, which are around 1,500.
Wow.
So you've got so many theatres in one area for people to go to, whereas Australia, each city has maybe one, each city will have a major performing arts centre like QPAC in Brisbane or like entertainment centres, and then they'll have their one or two theatre companies and then that's it. So it means if something's on that you really want to go and see,
but you don't live in the area, then you have to organise transport and everything else.
Then that becomes a big thing else. Mm. So I think it's just that we're spread out, which means our theatre is spread out, which means we don't have that melting pot in certain places. And each independent city has its own theatre scene as well. Melbourne is super strong with like independence, and Brisbane is like a little bit. Sydney, their independent scene is way more like showcase orientated. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's just a different kind of modus operandi, I guess. Yeah.
I want, it sounds like most of that comes from just the fact that there are so many more of them than us. Like it just seems like a numbers game.
Yeah,
but that makes you think like what it could be and that people are interested in the arts and all that kind of good stuff. I wanted to specifically ask about some acting stuff. So I know a bit about it, but also not really. But I'd love to talk about typecasting and knowing your typecast.
Yep.
So do you?
Okay. Yeah. So I've heard a lot of different schools of thought on this. And so I guess I've come to my own conclusion about it, but I know that it's so varied that everyone, it's kind of, you got to fight for yourself. So first off, it exists. It happens.
It's a real thing. But I also believe it's a different thing when it comes to film and TV.
So I think, and I'm just going to step into TV film land. Everyone has, I guess, a type and a certain like box that they're going to fit into. I'm never going to play Juliet. I never was going to play Juliet, like ever. So instead of pining over that, being like, what was me? Well, yeah. What can I do? And then how can I push that box out to include other things? So I think you need to own your type in terms of being like, I present as kind of blue collar, like a nurse, like I'm the funny best friend. I could probably, people would buy me more as an ambulance officer than like a doctor, but they would totally buy me as a cop, or you know what I mean? So it's just like a weird thing. And I think if you lean into that to try and actually just get work, be employed and be seen, and from there you can start to push those boundaries in terms of what you can and can't play.
Yeah.
Because and then with theatre, it's the same. You do tend to get, you can sometimes get locked in with certain things, but it's more like, oh, you can't play serious characters. But then you're like, well, yes, I can. And so that's when sometimes when you have a little bit more control over how you're
seen, then you can show them a different skill set. I think once you do control your own narrative, it will definitely get you more work.
You know, so if I audition and people go, show me a monologue, I'll always give them probably a comedic monologue first because that's my strong suit, and then anything else later.
Right.
So I think you just have to own your stereotype a little bit. Use it to your advantage, basically, because we want to be employed.
Yep.
And so if your stereotype is jerk lawyer, and all of a sudden there's a big role where you're on TV for 4 years and a recurring role as jerk lawyer, how fantastic. So, you know, instead of being upset about that, I'd be thrilled that you're employed for 4 years, and then you can, in your own time, go, well, what else am I interested in? And how do I get people to see that, you know? So that's my school of thought on that. But everyone has different things. Some people hate it, some people love it, but I'm kind of, I guess, I straddle both sides of the fence a little bit with that and just use it, own it, and then flip it when you can.
Yeah. No, I really like that. It kind of gives an ownership of the way people perceive you, but also it still allows you to sort of change what they might see in you, which is that, I mean, that just is a hugely positive way to look at typecasting. I wonder how do you think you identify your typecast, or your, like, what do you think your process goes through?
Painfully over years. No, I don't know, because I think it changes, you know, like, I've now entered like mum zone, but people still don't buy me as a mum, but I am of the age where I can be. Right. So it's like a certain type of mum they believe me as.
Okay.
So like drunk young mum, they're like, yeah, we can see that. But like uppity one straighty 180 mum, no one believes it. So it's it's interesting. And then, so I think it's half of how, it's feedback that you get from people of how they see you, I guess. And then it's your own perception as well, and trying to marry the two so that you're being truthful to what you're putting forward and not just trying to please others, because that's dumb. But you're kind of, when I was in uni, I wanted to be the most serious, dramatic human. Oh, just so much drama, drama, drama. So that was me. And then it was like third year, I started to just kind of have more fun. And realized that like I had strong comedic sensibilities, and then working on things after uni and stuff like that, I just developed that part of myself a bit more, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's I don't know. I feel like it's a constant thing. Some people know immediately. I never quite knew where I fit for a while, and just kind of had to keep experimenting with stuff. Still feel that way. There's still spots where I'm like, well, I don't know if I fit there, but I'll give it a go.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's tricky.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. I think I was just interested in typecast because it definitely, I think it helps you identify more about your acting style as well as how people would perceive you. And I just think that kind of self-reflection is really important. So, yeah.
Yeah. And look, and I've heard this time and time again from casting directors in America that also you need to be smart about the certain things that you put yourself forward for, because they need to see that you have an understanding of who you are as a performer as well. Mm. And that, like, you see so many people go, I'm 25, and all of a sudden
there is a role for a young mum of 30, and they still think they should go for it. And yes, you probably could, because it would be an interesting emotional acting stretch. But in general, try to represent yourself as something that is believable, especially if film and TV is a reflection of reality.
Don't be putting yourself forward to play, like, a German prisoner of war when you're never going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
It's just about having realistic expectations of yourself as well.
Yeah.
And that also comes with, like, with us also changing the way we look at how representation is as well. And that's across theater and film and TV, and it's lots of different things to consider. So it's like, how can you be smart about how you're seen and what you can portray and what you can do? Because at uni, you do play 55-year-old grandmas to try and, like, I don't know, because you're a bunch of uni students and everyone has to do everything.
Yeah.
Which is great, but it also means that sometimes I think we jump ahead maybe a couple of steps quicker than we should. Mm. So it's just about owning your niche and then working out how to break that mold a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know.
No, yeah, okay. I like that. I wanted to ask, like, you have a fairly successful theatre-based career here in Australia, and I wonder what it is about screen acting that made you and continues to make you sort of seek related opportunities in the US out.
I think it's multiple factors. Mm. I think it's needing change and needing to push yourself, and the opportunity for stories and being seen in different ways, I think, is always something that I've been interested in. Again, also, I'm female of a certain age, which means that theatre roles start to dry up until you get older again. Mm. And TV, there is more, especially in America, I found. Mm. I think that's changing here, though, that there's more roles and opportunity across the gamut of age and experience. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you're the young person, you're cool 20s finding something, and then all of a sudden you hit your weird 30s to 40s and there's not much space for you, and then you're 40 plus and then all of a sudden you can be a mum again, and then you can be a grandma, and that's really much all that's on offer for you. Right. So I felt that if I stayed in Australia that I could potentially have a big gap in my career trajectory. So I didn't want that. So I saw elsewhere. So, yeah.
That's fair. And do you
think... That was a big part of it for me. And that may not be everyone's experience. And some people might listen to that and go, bullshit, and that's totally fine. But that was just how I was feeling about stuff. So yeah. I was just like, I don't want to just have to wait until all of a sudden people believe me as a mum and then I can get work again. Yep. So, yeah, so it was just a way. It was just a way of going, and just a different mode of you know, being on set and learning that skill set of, like, waiting around and then being on point when, you know, you're finally called in, and telling a story out of sequence as an actor, and the fact then that it lasts forever, that your choices and decisions are there, and they exist on film, and people can look at them, forever. You know, so. I just found that as a really great challenge as well, an opportunity to stretch myself as an actor.
Yeah.
So absolutely. That was, yeah.
Do you think the way we have certain roles, and that when a woman becomes a certain age that we no longer have roles for her, is that something that you would wish to change, or do you see that as the nature of the industry?
I feel like it's a constant shift and ebb and flow, and I feel like the conversation that was a big conversation a few years ago, and now the conversation has shifted, as it should, to diversity and representation, as opposed to just gender and representation. And also within that, now diversity is in terms of like ethnicity,
cultural, and also gender is now bigger than a binary of male and female. The industry is now looking at those different life experiences and wanting to truthfully represent them on stage. The
conversation of me going, I worry about my place in certain times in my life, is part of that bigger conversation of how do we stretch the stories we tell just beyond a man's midlife crisis, and the play being about that, and then everyone revolves around that. That was just me being blunt. I think it's a constant shift and ebb and change that we're going through. And I think TV is progressing a lot quicker than theatre is, and because TV has also exploded in terms of like the way TV is being made now. You know, the focus was so much more on film, and now TV is huge. So I think that the conversations are moving a lot quicker in film and TV than they are in theatre.
Wow.
In terms of representation and stories and different types of experiences being represented. Sorry to bring it down a notch.
No. Yeah, it's like that's kind of what I wanted, because that was a really interesting answer, sort of about how things develop and our ideals for entertainment and acting and all that kind of stuff change. And I particularly liked the comparison between the TV is like becoming a lot more adept to that than theater is. And that just makes me think a lot about our theater culture here in Australia. And sometimes the general consensus is that it's old and classical and aging. But it definitely gives that hope that it may change.
Pockets that are very much stuck in traditional modes that need to like get a kick up the butt. And I also think that there are other pockets where there are people that are really pushing envelopes and really creating new exciting work that is much more inclusive. But I think that's also very true then of film and TV. There are still also old traditional ways of doing things that aren't working as well. So a slow progression, and there are always people that are going to want to speed it up. It's just about who's where is the seesaw, where's the pendulum swinging towards, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I am feeling particularly somber now and inward thinking. I am happy to...
I think it's a good thing. I think...
Change is necessary, and...
It feels like a lot of work, but I actually think it's positive. So,
yeah. No, I definitely agree with that sentiment. But yeah, it makes me, yeah, like gets the gears turning about the industry a little bit. I'm happy to ask the last question if you're okay with that.
Great.
Yeah. So I ask this question of all my guests, and it's just, if you could give advice to your younger self, what would you tell them?
Do everything that you're doing. Keep doing that. But try and... I think sometimes I was very bullheaded or narrow-minded with what I thought I could or couldn't achieve. And so I concentrated a lot more on theatre, because that's where I felt comfortable or where I had connections. So I think I just switched off other parts of my brain and opportunity, because I really wanted to succeed there. Whereas I think you just have to keep diversifying. And so...
I would tell myself to keep a few options and tendrils open.
But otherwise, no, I think my younger self didn't do too bad.
nice.
I'd say... find a different way to fund your theatre instead of getting a credit card. That would be my big one.
God.
Which is how many of us started off, just, you know, doing stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
And save more.
Earlier on.
Everyone save more money earlier on.
I should definitely take that on. I don't know if I will, but I should definitely take that on.
Well, you see, I would have been exactly the same. My older self would talk to my younger self, and my younger self would tell my older self to go fuck herself.
Yeah, so, like, hey, I'm having a good time. What do you want?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I have, like I said, I have so much to reflect on now, especially within our industry and the different sort of the differences between America and Australia and the numbers game and yada yada yada. Typecast was interesting. I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and do it.
And that's it for this interview. It ended on such a nice note. To be more open-minded towards your own capabilities. I like it. I think there is definitely a reason Amy has done so well in this industry, because it's clear she's pushed for it. I mean, on the very fact that she was going from Australia to America to pursue different practices back and forth proves how hard she has hustled. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking to Amy and getting her perspectives on the questions. And it seems like she'd thought through them like these are questions she had asked herself. I also hope that my added in audio wasn't too distracting and helped to keep the flow of information. But yeah, otherwise, amazing interview. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, then send an email to anactorandamike@gmail.com or swing a message to the Facebook page. Next up on episode 30, I actually speak with one of Amy's classmates from her uni days. Although they took very different paths, Est has become one of the three artistic directors of Shake and Stir. Can't wait for you to hear it. Until then, keep making art and being spectacular.